you've landed inside Launch Street, the Business Innovation Podcast, where we interview top innovators out there shaking things up so you can innovate, differentiate, and get further faster. Since you're here, we know you're the type of person that recognizes the importance of unlocking your innovation advantage so you can compete and win. And now, your host, the person that has worked with leading companies like Disney, Procter & Gamble, Arrow Electronics, the U.S. Army Research Labs, and Red Robin on upping their innovation advantage, Tamara Gontor.
And we're back. Tamara here. Welcome, welcome, whoever and wherever you are. Probably in your homes, like me. So before we dig into this podcast, I just want to remind us all of something that I think is really important, because in times like this of uncertainty, in times of change and a need or a urgency for adaptation, you know, we turn to innovation, and that's important and right. But the thing I want to remind us all of is that the very first step in innovation is a human one. It starts with you. It's understanding how you innovate and then your strengths around innovation, and then channeling that into relevancy, value, and opportunity. It's not found elsewhere. It's not found outside. It's found within you, in your mind. It's actually really amazing. We all have this ability. In your everyday innovator style, how you uniquely innovate is what helps you do that. So here's something, Mark from Boston, he's an everyday innovator. He's actually an instinctual collaborative. This is what he told me. This is what he emailed me. Tamara, understanding how I innovate not only gave me the mindset and tools I needed to see myself through this, but also made me feel more in control because now I feel equipped to deal with the uncertainty. Thanks, Tamara. Oh no, thank you, Mark from Boston. I think your feedback helps us all. This is why I'm so passionate about this. I want us all to have that same sense of control and empowerment that Mark is talking about. He comes from the innovative mind. And guess what? All you got to do to know how you innovate and to get that sense of control and empowerment is go to our website and take the IQE assessment, the Innovation Quotient Edge assessment. That's it. It'll tell you how you innovate. And also, by the way, if you're one of those people out there who know what type of everyday innovator you are, go get the toolkit. This is what helps you put it into action daily. Understand how you innovate. Recognize how to channel that into the relevancy, value, and opportunity. Why wouldn't you do that for yourself? We need that more than ever. And the thing that I'm seeing is those who are innovating now in the thick of it, they're the ones that are coming out stronger on the other side. Be one of those people. Let's all be one of those people. Why hold back? Okay, now today's podcast, because it's a good one. There are a lot of things that keep me up at night, especially right now. And one of them, though, is how to stay innovative when the ground under us is shaking. And right now, that's exactly the experience that a lot of us are having. And I think today's guest, Mark Johnson, will really help us answer this question through what he considers, or what he calls, a forward-back innovation approach. And right now seems like the perfect time to do some forward-back innovation. So let me tell you a bit about Mark. Mark is co-founder and senior partner at Innosight, a growth strategy consulting company with offices in Massachusetts, Singapore, and Switzerland, which he co-founded with Harvard Business School professor Clay Christensen. He has been a strategic advisor to both Global 1000 and startup companies in a wide range of industries. He's a co-author of the forthcoming book, Lead from the Future, How to Turn Visionary Thinking into Breakthrough Growth, kind of a manifesto for future-back thinking and a hands-on guide to long-term planning, strategy development, and execution. Here's a cool thing I just want to point out, by the way, this kind of forward-back, lead from the future, that couldn't be more relevant than it is right now, because going from the present forward or from the past on, it just is not going to work, right? Things are disrupted. Things are different. And we need to acknowledge that and kind of look from a future back approach. I think you'll really like this. We dig in deep on how the future is like an impressionist painting, not a photograph, how to do what he calls clean slate thinking, and how to get over the present forward fallacy. I think that's a trap I'm seeing a lot of us get into right now. By the way, I think really pay attention to the clean slate thinking part, because I think right now we're all being forced into that. This is a good innovation one. So, hey, do me a favor. get your everyday innovator style, get the toolkit, get that sense of empowerment and control, and let's do some forward back thinking. All right, let's do this.
Mark, I'm so glad you came by Inside Launch Street. I can't wait to dig into this.
Well, thanks for having me, Tamara. I'm thrilled to be here.
So since our first time meeting, what's the one thing people would be surprised to learn about you?
I think one thing that has been my long-lasting passion has been about airplanes, model airplanes. I started building them at a very young age and then started flying model airplanes and radio controlled, and ended up with the pride of my mom taking the FAA exam for getting my private pilot's license at supposedly one of the earliest ages, basically barely 14 years old, and then soloed at 16. And went to the Naval Academy with an aerospace engineering degree, but the eyes finally caught up to me and didn't stay 20/20. So I didn't end up actually flying in the Navy, but airplanes have been my lifelong passion regardless, and continue to this day.
So you had your first solo flight at 16. I would, as a parent myself, I have a 15-year-old, I would have panicked.
I think my mom semi did, but my dad was there to reassure her, and everything worked out okay.
And I don't, it's so interesting to me. There's something about airplanes that is so fascinating. And maybe, you know, I fly all the time for work, as I'm sure you do too. And it's like magic every time we take off. And I know it's not. Like, I get it, science and physics and air pop particles and stuff like that. But there's something about being in the air that is so fascinating and magical, isn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, it's been, my dad was a fighter pilot in World War II. I sort of picked up the interest and the passion from him. And, you know, ever since I had the first opportunity to fly in a small plane, I've loved it, just both the feeling in the plane, but also what you can see outside of the plane. It's just a feeling that is hard to replicate any other way.
I'm afraid I'm going to die every time we go up in a plane, which is ridiculous because I fly every week, but I still am afraid. But I hear what you're saying. I mean, they're magical. There's just, the whole thing is magical. I'm going to use that, because when I think about airplanes, I was actually thinking about like seeing the horizon and, like, you know, way further ahead actually than you see when you're standing on the ground. And I think that's a great transition over to kind of what we're talking today and kind of your focus. The first question I wanted to ask you about, because your whole thing is really much more about that long-term thinking, future back, which we'll get into, but I wanted to back it up for a second and ask you, why is it that we get so trapped in short-term thinking, kind of in our line of sight, or even past thinking?
Yep. Well, I mean, I have to be sympathetic to all of us. I mean, we're really kind of stuck in a sticky wicket here about short-term thinking. One is, you know, again, I'll try not to say this too many times, but I wrote this in the book about just all of the cognitive biases that are against us. I mean, yeah. You know, we just have our brains wired to be more concerned about the here and now. And, you know, I won't go into all of the particular biases, but suffice to say, there's a whole set of them that put us sort of against, you know, spending real thoughtful time in the long term. We're just wired for more of the here and now. And the second, because we're human beings, you know, the rewards and incentives that are created by human beings only reinforce that. You know, in the financial side, it's the short-termism of the financials, of meeting the quarterly earnings of your public company, that reinforce that. And then there's even what I call ecosystem influences, you know, being sort of tied to hedge fund investors or pension funds. All of those end up ascribing to, you know, connect with people and individuals and companies that tend to put them further short-term. So I think those are influences that have been around a long time, needless to say, the biases of individuals, the organizational rewards and incentives, and then what I call the ecosystem rewards and incentives. But what makes it even worse, and I think this is counterintuitive in today's society, is we are bombarded more than ever with information, and technology and innovation happen faster than ever. And I know that's a bit cliche, but the noise of things being more volatile and uncertain, you know, being companies being disrupted more easily, all of that volatility and uncertainty actually makes the situation even worse, that individuals and companies end up prioritizing the need to address sort of all these urgent things because, you know, the ground's sort of moving under your feet. And so we've become, even in my opinion, more short-term oriented, not less so, in this frenetic world that we live in.
I have a couple questions for you on this such important stuff. I want to back up to cognitive bias just for one second, or just our mind. And I'm sure, and I don't know if this part is, I skimmed through the book. I don't know if this part is in it, but you know, I was talking to someone the other day about Moore's law and how the rate of change is a big hockey, like a very sharp hockey stick. And our cognitive ability to change is more like a gradual line. So we've hit this tipping point, or this inflection point, where the hockey stick is shooting up and we're still going gradually, which is kind of part of the challenge. Do you see that not just at the individual level, but at the organizational level too, where the change around just can't, it's so much faster than the ability, not just of the humans, but of the system to change?
Absolutely. I mean, I think you've hit it spot on, Tamara. The organization sits off of processes, rules, norms, and metrics that any kind of organization sits, as you've compared Moore's law, it sits on a linear path. You know, the whole notion of sustaining innovation, you know, the whole idea that I talk about in the book of being present forward, right, incrementing off of today, all of those are indicative of a linear projection forward. And to your point, what's happening out in the environment isn't always one-to-one matching with that linearity. And that's where I think this has become, in my view, this lack of long-term thinking has actually led to a crisis. Because what I argue is the ability to shift the curve for individuals and organizations starts with being able to think in a long-term way and bring that alive through the ability to envision and, you know, and create what that future ought to be. That's the only way you can get out of a present forward linear path to a more discontinuous transformative path.
I want to ask you about something else you said kind of quickly, but I think it's really important. And that's that, you know, we feel like the ground is moving under us, mm-hmm, all the time now, which I couldn't agree more. I mean, I can't tell you the number of people, and you're probably in the same position, who after a keynote or whatever will come up to me and say, I just feel like I go to bed with the world being one way and wake up with it being another. Like, how am I supposed to keep up, like, all this volatility and this change? And maybe we're kind of going to dig into this when we talk about future back. But the question that kind of pops into my head is, oh my gosh, well, how do I balance this shaking ground that's always underneath me and this, like, move fast, fail fast, innovate, adapt, right? Like, all this pressure to keep up with change, with that need, the need for long-term thinking. And let me just say, Mark, I'm with you. Like, we need to get to a more long-term place. We're always in reactive mode if we're constantly just trying to get our balance today. But how do you think about balancing those two?
Yeah, well, one, I would liken it to, you know, let's go back to the individual. You know, many people ascribe to meditation, right? And they say, gosh, I need to meditate to be able to, yeah, kind of handle the rest of the day. Well, you know, any real meditation effort, I think, I mean, I guess some would argue they can do it in 20 minutes, but let's just say for the purposes of this conversation, you know, you got to put in a good 30 minutes where you're absolutely in quiet space, and you're not, you know, doing anything other than really trying to, you know, kind of bring the mind body together and put yourself in a place of relaxation and, you know, create the what meditation can do for you emotionally and mentally, so forth. You got to carve out that time. And, you know, it's easy to say, gosh, you know, my day is just replete with all these different things. I just don't have the time. Well, you got to make the time, and you have to say it's a priority. And, you know, take the analogy, you got to put your rocks in first, the jar, before you put the sand. You know, because if you put the sand in and then the rocks, they're not going to fit. But if you put the rocks in and then pour the sand over it. So how do you think about prioritizing the things that maybe not urgent, because these certainly anything around sort of planning past the horizon and thinking about the long term will never seem urgent. But the question, right, is it vital? You know, is it the frog in the boiling water problem that we might face? So I think the short answer is, how do you get an individual or set of individuals in an organization to realize the importance of having to create this mind share in the space to think imaginatively, to think out in the future, to think about beyond the core, and give some allocation of time? And, you know, I talk about it again in the book that this is not like going to be ever, you know, a 50, 60% of your time. I think it's a 10% to 20% allocation of leadership team's time towards looking towards the 5 to 10 year horizon and trying to be able to formulate a point of view about it and then what you need to do today. So I think it's about allocation of time, just like we talk about innovation projects, you know, allocating between core and adjacent and, right, and new. I think you have to allocate time in a similar sort of portfolio mindset.
So it's interesting you say about the meditation. I think you said 20 minutes, right? Uh-huh. I'm laughing a little bit because I had a half an hour between my last phone call and our recording of this podcast. So I did a 17 minute meditation and now I'm like, I should have done 3 more minutes. but to your point about finding the time, right? Like that was one of the things where I could have spent 30 minutes doing something else.
Right.
And I have a long to-do list, but to your point, you do have to prioritize the things that benefit you in the long run. And it's not just about meditation, whatever that is, right? Whatever those rocks are to you. One of the things
absolutely
that you mentioned in your book that kind of got my eyes open a little bit was the present forward fallacy. Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about that? Because that made me pause.
Yes. Well, I mean, it's kind of a catchy phrase, right? But what it means is that it's the misconception, maybe that's the right word, or as I said in the words, the seductive notion, you know, that an existing business can be extended out in time indefinitely. Like we just keep incrementing, right? We keep reviewing every year our strategic plan, and we somehow always seem to have that line going upward, right? I mean, you never see business units providing an annual plan that shows that it's in decline, or at least I haven't.
No, there's something else, another way to flip the numbers.
Yeah, there's some way to flip the numbers. And so, you know, the present forward fallacy is really about, you know, this idea that we're invulnerable, right? We can just keep making improvements, sustaining innovations, and you know, this business will last forever. And you know, the argument is that at some point, as we know, right, that there's, as we call, innovation headroom, there's at some point you reach a marginal utility. You can keep innovating, but the value that gets created by that next incremental version of product is not realized in the marketplace and is not needed. And, you know, in the classic Clay Christensen work, you know, we'd call that overshooting. Right. So present forward fallacy is just thinking you can continue to build off of today into the future and not realizing at some point the orthodoxies, the theory of the business, as Peter Drucker would say, at some point is no longer going to work. And you've got to think about, planning for new growth businesses because the existing one is going to commoditize or get disrupted or what have you.
You know, it reminds me of a conversation I was having with a leader at a consumer packaged goods company the other day. And we were talking about how, you know, every business, whether it's a brand or the kind of greater organization itself, has a life cycle. And the challenge is like we go up that curve and we get to the top and we're like, yes, we're here. And it's really not until that decline gets so steep that we can't ignore it anymore, to your point about like departmental reports in, you know, until to get so steep and we're already so far in the decline that we start to go, oh my gosh, we have to do something about it. What he was saying was what he was really struggling with, and I feel like kind of the work that you do really helps with that, is he said, I wish when we're at the top of that curve, that's when my leaders and teams would say, we need to think about what our next life cycle is going to be, because it's not until we're on such a decline that, you know, and then we're like really struggling and oftentimes can't get back on track.
Absolutely. You know, and I think I'm trying to remember what executive said it, but to your point, the the movement towards the very top and actually getting to the top is a very dangerous place, to your point. You know, it's really right. because at that point, it's number one is, you know, it's only probably going to go toward decline, you know. And then the second is, of good friend Wendell Weeks, who's CEO of Corning, put it, you know, it's way easier to hold on to a hill, you know, when you're at the top than it is to take a hill. And so, you know, you have all of the motivation just to defend what you have
right.
to the point, you know, where you're keeping this present forward thing going, because it just seems so scary to try to take the new hill in terms of the ambiguity about it, the length of time to really get it to fruition, the level of perceived risk.
Right.
You know, just the number of sort of iterations, it just sort of puts you out of your comfort zone organizationally. And hence why you and I both see so rarely companies systematically driving breakthrough innovation.
Yeah. I love that kind of what you just said about it's like you go from offense to defense, you know, like suddenly you're just defending your territory, which is never a sustainable place in the long run either. I mean, I think we see it in sports all the time, if I were to bring it back to sports analogy, right?
No, yeah, for sure. And I was just going to say, Tamar, the other thing where you see it in spades is, you know, how many companies are obsessed with the competition?
Yeah, totally.
You know, that becomes defensive, to your point, as opposed to really caring about the customer and where she's going, right?
It's so interesting to say that. I just yesterday was having a strong conversation with someone on my team about I was talking about errors in the newsletter, because, you know, you pump out a lot of content, right? You got a lot of eyes reading it. And they said, you know, it's interesting how many errors I'm seeing in our competitor stuff. And I almost blew my lid, because I was like, I don't actually care what the competitors are doing. What I want is this standard for us.
Yep.
But to your point, like, it's like, oh, well, I mean, the competition often puts out mediocre crap, and we go, okay, well, that's good enough. So we'll follow what they're doing. But at the end of the day, just because they're doing it doesn't mean it's the breakthrough, the right thing to do.
No, totally agree.
So I think all of this kind of leads really well into my next question, which is really the premise of your book, Lead from the Future. And it's a new way of thinking. And I think it really overcomes a lot of things you and I were just talking about with cognitive bias and that kind of life cycle curve and all that. And that is a term that you call future back. So tell us about how that works.
Well, I think there are two parts of it. One is the nature of thinking, the mode of thinking, and then the other is the process. You know, that there's literally a process that, as it sounds, going from the future back. But starting with the thinking aspect of it, it's really about getting ourselves to be able to clear the headspace in the mind. And as you know, that's really critical for innovation, but it more broadly critical for being able to imagine the future that isn't necessarily a linear extrapolation from today, and be able to anticipate systematic change. So future back thinking is really about attributes such as what could be as opposed to what is. So we're talking about the art of the possible, and then what do you have to believe for that kind of thing to be true? It's about thinking around the creative right brain side of things. You know, it's the design thinking movement and then some. You know, it's about being able to clean sheet something and be able to say, hey, as we think about these things converging 5 to 10 years from now, from a technology, socioeconomic, customer point of view, how would we actually blueprint a system of businesses to be able to embrace what potentially is a very different future? So future back, opposite to present forward, where present forward is so much building on a base of what is and incrementing off of a set of orthodoxies. Future back as a mode of thinking is, say, we've got to be in a space where the mind is clear. We certainly can take trends and information into the future, but the first part of it is to think in a more creative, more what we'd say abductive kind of way, you know, clean sheet system thinking. And then the process piece of it is literally putting yourself in the future and crafting a point of view, not just about the way the world works and the environment and not just about then a vision statement, but literally a vision of a portfolio of businesses that comprise the core, adjacent, and new, and how they would look to best meet the challenges of the future, and then take those business concepts at the high level and walk them back in increments from 5 to 10 years out, say in 2 year increments to today, to a set of initiatives, and again, core, adjacent, and new, that can get started today on the pathway to meeting the future. So it's on, if you will, on steroids. It's right to left thinking.
So I love it. Here's my question that I want to understand more, because I love kind of this blank slate or clean sheet, I think you said, thinking, and the idea of, hey, let's work backwards. It's funny, somebody kind of about a year ago told me that same thing about setting my own personal goals. Mm-hmm. About the problem with our personal goals is we say, here's where I am today, what do I do next, versus here's where I want to go, and then work backwards to today. And that was actually a big shift for me and helped me achieve those goals. And I think for the same reason that you're talking about is, you envision where you want to go and work backwards. And when we start with today, there's so much baggage that comes along with that, that we don't actually get to the place we're trying to go. If I'm a leader in a company and I'm thinking to myself, great, but I'm inundated in today. Mm-hmm. How do I get out of that mind space and into a more future back mind space? Let's start there, and then we'll work with team and everything else.
Sure. Well, I mean, back to our earlier discussion about you just have to make the time, like for meditation and, putting the rocks in first. If you can first get to a place to value the importance of spending time in the 5 to 10 year horizon, then as the leadership team, you would carve out the time, say once a quarter, maybe it's once every 4 months, where you spend a day as a leadership team in this different mindset, where instead of operating and executing, you're exploring and you're envisioning and you're discovering insights and potentiality. You're thinking in this different way, and you're carving out the time through what we would call strategic dialogues to be in this, what we would say is certainly a messier, more iterative type of process. I've understand, from some of our automotive work, we didn't work directly with them, but that BMW just facing a major transformation in the automotive industry between electric vehicle technology, autonomous vehicle technology, connectivity. They're seeing a potential paradigm shift in the industry, yeah. And they've made the decision to spend once a quarter for a day just talking about their future and the implications of that future and what they're going to do about it. And you got to spend that day in a much messier, it's not about, hey, people coming in and giving us data and then we're making decisions and allocating resources. You have to shift mindsets to be much more about developing a point of view and having disagreement, and because you're not going to be talking about facts, you're going to be talking a lot about assumptions and trying to get to a shared view about the way the world's going to work.
It's interesting you mentioned about the not looking at data. I would love your opinion on this, but I do feel like sometimes when you're talking about where we're headed, those data charts force you into one direction.
Yes.
And then you don't get to explore the others.
Totally. I mean, and think about all of the sort of breakthrough transformative efforts, right? The Ted Levitt marketing guru from the Harvard Business School, said back in the 60s, are you a railroad company or are you a transportation company? Mm-hmm. And I think the more you're dependent on data, which is a reflection of the past and the present at best, it's going to put you into the industry silos and into the traditional way that things are sliced and diced and managed. And it's not going to allow for the associative thinking, that happens with really trying to drive breakthrough. I mentioned Steve Jobs and Apple in the book because you really can't not mention him. Apple really moved from a PC company into a lifestyle company, into a consumer products company, into a music company. It was being able to let go of all the data that said where PCs were going to go and imagine what the future of consumer products would be, you know, coupled with computers. That's really where the great clean break happened. And certainly no McKinsey or BCG or any firm would have been able to do what he did just by giving him a lot of analysis about industry structure and trends.
You know, what I love about that example too is if you were to do, I can guarantee if you were to do focus groups back in the day when they first created the iPad, or actually let's use Airbnb and Uber. If you had gone to a focus group to test ideas, right, which is really to your point, that's the present forward method. Mm-hmm. And said, would you stay at a stranger's house or get in a stranger's car? Like, I guarantee you people would have said no. Right?
Right.
Versus kind right. of create to your point. And I think with the iPad too, like, hey, can I give you a device that doesn't do what your phone does? You can't make phone calls from it. No, it doesn't have the, you know, computing power of a computer, but it's kind of somewhere in between in terms of size. I can't imagine people have been like, yeah, I want that. That sounds great. That's the future. Yet here we are.
Absolutely. And yet here we are. Exactly. and that's kind of why, Scott Cook of Intuit, the chairman of Intuit, talks about, their work of disruptive teams is to not spend a lot of time trying to analyze or develop volume forecasts or, try to predict too much. What they're really focused on is trying to figure out the strength of an important unmet job to be done or need and tying that to something that they think can address it. And then figuring out a way if they can get both of those to be strong. The job is really important unmet. The need is really unsatisfied, and their opportunity with a solution. Then they have then the best thing that's way better than market research is to actually go and tie it to a customer and see how he or she responds, and then be able to figure out the next step of can they make a transaction out of it.
Right. Well, there's nothing that tells you if your idea is valid or not, whether people open up their wallets, which is a way better.
Right.
I'm so intrigued by this idea of, like, for example, leadership taking the time to really explore what the future could be, not to be set based on one data chart or even just based on, being bogged down by what's happening today. If you were to take your team of leaders, or maybe you do this with clients, to explore the future, what types of questions or conversation starters would you use to get the team thinking in that direction? Because, to your point in the beginning, with not just cognitive bias, but I think also workload, I find it sometimes that people just need a little bit of a push to get out of the today mindset and into something more future driven.
Yeah. Well, first and foremost, Tamara, which I've always found fascinating, and it happens virtually every time, there's such an interesting conversation and debate about what is the time horizon? What is the time horizon that gets you past the planning and forecast, traditional planning and forecasting? What's the time horizon that could start to be in a place where there's potential for inflection points or what we would call faint signals or early fault lines? And just that conversation alone is really powerful, because in the process of figuring out, should we plan, 5 years, 8 years, 10 years, even 15 years in terms of this exercise of being able to think and plan future back for the long-term aspect. By the way, doesn't anyway take away the short term, you have to keep doing the short term, but this longer term effort and finding that time horizon is one way that we've found and it's the start of every effort that really gets people talking, because you can't really define the time horizon uncoupled with talking about different trends, different potentials for disruption, potential different industry inflection points. Having that conversation in a systematic way about how all these different things, whether they're technology or commoditization trends or what have you, could converge, and where does the leadership team think that they can start to be converging? And that's the kind of time frame you want to be spending in conversation. And so I'll just stop there, but I think I think, you know, it may not seem like much, but just specifying the time horizon is a very powerful way to get leadership mindset out of the here and now.
The answer may be no here. Is there a specific time frame or is there a minimum, you know, like a minimum speed limit that we say, hey, anything below 3 years, you're going to get trapped in today?
Yeah, I mean, my argument, and you know, there are exceptions, of course, but they think they're on the tail end of the distribution on either side. To me, the sweet spot for 98% of companies, I don't know, maybe it's 95%, but is the 5 to 10 year, because our research shows, you know, 80% of companies never get past thinking the 5 years, and you know, there's only 10% that ever think in the 8 to 10 year. I think the space that's really being ignored is this 5 to 10 year. And I think to your point, minimum speed limit, I think you need at least 5 years, even for some sort of fast moving software company with just a few exceptions, to be able to get into a place of discomfort. You want to be in an area of discomfort where there's a lot of ambiguity, where there's clearly uncertainty, but where you give yourself an opportunity to see some things potentially converge. If you're too close in the 3 to 5, you know, you're overlapped with planning that's probably already happening anyway.
Right. You're probably executing on that.
And you're executing on it, and you've got a lot of noise in the system. You know, I have a good colleague, friend of mine, Bob Johansson of the Institute of the Future. He likes to say it's easier to actually plan and spend time in the 10-year horizon than it is in the 3-year horizon, just because you're out of the noise and you're out of the threats and the intimidation and the parochial interests. Because a lot of people say, oh, well, that's 8 years out. I don't have to feel so threatened because that's such a long time out. And in fact, I talk about some of the benefits of this future horizon. You know, when you get out past 5 years, again, as the minimum speed limit, you know, I talk about it as it silences the distracting noise of the here and now, and it mm-hmm. allows you to see those faint signals. And I think really critically is expands your scope of vision to really be able to better see those opportunities that are going to take five or more years to incubate and scale.
How do you navigate the pushback that I could maybe see from some saying, well, I don't know what's going to happen in 10 years. Like, change happens so fast and it's often surprising. How do you navigate that pushback?
So two ways. One is, by way of analogy, we're talking about an impressionist painting, not a photograph. Mm. So the angst is coming from, oh, you know, how could anybody be so perfect, you know, with clarity and or certainty? We're not, of course, nobody has a crystal ball, but we've seen it time and time again, building a shared point of view about sort of this rough impressionist painting creates a lot of purpose, and it creates a very specified direction, which is powerful for the organization. So one is to think about it as creating aspiration and inspiration for the organization through this impressionist painting. The second is that it's not a one and done effort. I mean, it's not like, hey, we're going to do this every 5 years. Ideally, you're going to be like BMW and revisit this 5 to 10 year vision every 3 months. And there's data that comes back based on the market and what you're doing and just new information about future trends and all those kinds of things. So this impressionist painting is evergreen. You're always putting paint strokes on it, and you're always, you know, moving things around, if you will, and continually shaping that vision, that point of view. So the combination of, you know, not being a photograph and the fact that you're iterating, you're being agile, both with your initiatives and with the endpoint, is what allows the 5 to 10 year to be eminently doable.
I love that. I'm glad to hear the what you said about the kind of impressionist painting versus a photograph, because I do think that, you know, the fear some people might have. And I want to talk a little bit about it because I think it's the elephant, mm-hmm. you know, in people's heads.
Yeah, absolutely.
They listen to this kind of stuff. And I want them to get over it with me, is that, you know, well, now I'm locked into a future plan that may or may not happen because maybe there'll be, let's just use cars as an example. Like maybe there'll be a whole different breakthrough in autonomous right. cars that I would have never envisioned coming from left field. But what you're really right. saying is this is about constantly looking to the future. And I would have to imagine that you've seen with your clients that it's also about creating the future you decide, which I think often when
yes. we
look at the brands and businesses we love, they've created something that we've then said, yes, I want that. It's not that they just followed with us in step.
Absolutely. To that point, Tamara, we talk all the time about, or at least I do, I think in the firm, you know, with the Wayne Gretzky quote of skate to where the puck's going.
Yes.
But to your point, the better way to say it is not just skate to where the puck is going, but how do you help shape where the puck should go?
Right.
And that opportunity only comes if you're looking out to where the puck, you know, can be anticipated and then being able to do things to help influence where, you know, what that puck's path is going to be. So, you know, I think to your point, there has to be an urgency to change our mindset that yeah. this is the problem. So many people say it's a fool's errand. You can't predict the future. I'm not going to be around. If you want another example, you know, to take the flip side of this and say that this is no better a solution. So, you know, I've worked with defense contractors, and when they were trying to get beyond their, you know, government programs, you know, defense programs and get some, you know, added growth outside of defense, they said, well, where else can we go? And they started to go into the energy sector. And they said, because, you know, they're big, you know, the big capital investments were great at program management of large scale capital mm-hmm. efforts. And so they went into it just based on that, but they had no vision for it. They just sort of said, well, this is the next best thing. That was classic present forward. And so many of those efforts have failed because they were never behind it in terms of what's really going to be the anticipated value proposition of this. How is this going to really mesh with our business in the long term? And so absent being able to think out there, that's not a better solution to do a Hail Mary for some breakthrough idea in your portfolio that's built off of today. I mean, that this is all this is about is taking and coming up with a better informed view about that portfolio of innovation initiatives and doing it from the future back as opposed to from the present forward, which is not a better way to come up with breakthrough initiatives, I can tell you without any doubt.
Yeah, well, as you said in the beginning, right, that's what just leads to kind of, you know, trying to out better, right? I call it the ER trap. It's like, I'm going to be a little bit better, stronger, faster, smoother, whatever. And that just clutters the marketplace because everybody else is doing it too.
Absolutely.
I wanted to ask you about something I saw on your website. It was just three words that came together that actually kind of spoke to me as a way to get into the future back mindset, which was, it was this, you had this longer sentence, but the three words were clearly, creatively, and expansively. Will you talk about how those three things come together to create that future back kind of mindset or approach to work?
Well, I think it ties nicely to the important mental process or learning process or mechanism which enables future back thinking and method or process to work. And that's what I basically describe as the learning loop. And what the learning loop is about, you know, that this iterative process where you start with exploration. You know, what assumptions can we make about the future, for example, and, you know, begin to build, you know, a point of view, a foresight, if you will, about fault lines and faint signals and all those kinds of things that come through debate and discussion. And after you've done exploration and you've created, if you will, some of this this clarity, you know, the clearly part, then it comes the creative juices to say, okay, this is the assumptions we're making about the future. What does our enterprise future state need to look like? That's the envisioning part of this learning loop. So explore, envision, and then discover. And discover, I think, would be to then be able to get real knowledge and insights. And the discover part is, how do we experiment on our future today? So what are the seeds that we plant today that mitigate risks, that we start moving in that direction of our intended future, you know, starting small, starting in a way that we can test and learn. So this explore, envision, discover loop is the future backside of thinking and doing versus the operate and execute of present forward. And what we have on the website isn't necessarily, you know, directly coming from the learning loop, but that's the way I think about it, is that being able to do things clearly, creatively, and expansively requires a different way of learning, this learning loop of explore, envision, and discover. And the last thing I would say about it is, it's best done through conversation, dialectically, through, you know, being able to talk back and forth in a very egalitarian and a very debate, you know, sort of diverge, converge way, to really tease out, you know, a shared point of view and alignment and an understanding about, you know, how you would be able to create the future and own it.
I would love an example around, you said experiment on the future today. I'm assuming there's a comma there, comma today.
Yeah.
So I'd love an example of that, because I think that's a part where a lot of us struggle with, okay, I know I want to head there. I think that's like, that's the vision, but I need to know, like, is that even right? I mean, not that we can get certainty, right? To your point about the impressionist painting, but I'd love an example around that, because I think that's the place where we could all use some help.
So let me give you two. I'll give you a quick one, and then maybe a more in-depth one. So the quick one is the you know, sort of the well-known example back to Steve Jobs and what happened with Apple. But it's so powerful, because what he did with his team is to look 10 years out in the year 2000. And the long story short is, he envisioned what he called the digital hub. Basically, the computer could connect to all of these future consumer devices, which he shared publicly as consumer devices that other people were making or other companies. What he didn't share was, he had a vision that they could actually get into the consumer device space themselves with the iPod and the iPhone and the iPad, right, and so forth. And so the example there is Steve Jobs and his top lieutenants envisioning 10 years out this digital hub and then some, and then walking it back. And as we know, it started in stages. It started with the iPod. The iPod actually started without iTunes, but then iTunes services were added, and then the iPhone in 2007, and then the iPad in 2010. So there's one quick example of envisioning the future intuitively, you know, with his team. You know, he didn't have future back language or whatever, but the method was to look in the future and then walk it back and then start with a set of experiments, starting with the iPod. And, you know, there were plenty of bumps in the road along the way. A piece of work that we've done that we're very proud of and proud of the company for doing it is Johnson & Johnson and their Janssen Pharmaceuticals division. They're a pharmaceutical manufacturing company that's all about treating diseases, and it's all about the pill. The tremendous here and now problems and tremendous pull that everything's kind of got to be about that business model. Well, their leader in the R&D side said, you know, we got to get out of just making the pills to treat people after the act. What about if we could prevent diseases in the first place, or intercept the progression of a disease before it really manifests into something horrible? Mm. So long story short is, what Bill Height and his team at Janssen did was, in 2014, to look all the way out to 2030 and look at the convergence of a set of technologies, both diagnostic as well as in the medical device space, you know, from a treatment side, you know, or sort of an intervention side, and think about all of those converging and come up with what was called a world without disease vision and a disease interception strategy. And they walked that back to what's been ongoing for the last 2 years, which is to first effort go after lung cancer and what's called the Lung Cancer Initiative, combining their medical technology sector with their pharmaceutical sector, bringing those together to develop an approach to intercept lung cancer before it actually even is at stage one. And there's been a lot of progress, and it's all about having crafted that strategy from the future back and implementing it through this initiative that starts with the Lung Cancer Initiative.
It's interesting. There's a second layer to what you're saying, I think, and correct me if I'm wrong, which is also having that 10-year vision, whatever that is the Impressionist painting, really does give you purpose in today when you start to take those new paths, those what seems risky, a little bit more uncertain. I would imagine that that connection really helps keep you innovating today.
Oh, totally. You know, it's a little bit of the, you got to have goals, right? You have to have something that sparks your passion and ignites an organization for the greater good. I think certainly there are plenty of things that we could be happening in the here and now that are very purposeful, but there's no way what's developed as a vision in the future should be and it almost always is imbued with lots of purpose. And right. And that purpose is just such a strong driving force to get the organization and its leaders to get past all of these earlier, earlier kind of biases and things we talked about of, you know, kind of being stuck in the short term. I mean, I wrote about this as well. The Calvary's not coming. There's not going to be any time soon where all of these short-term incentives, financial rewards are going to all of a sudden change and we're going to all be kind of long-term oriented. I think the way that we're going to overcome it is with the narrative about that Impressionist painting, that future that's imbued with lots of purpose that drives the organization to get past all of these sort of transactional pieces and, you know, sort of things in the brain to just grab onto that narrative and hold on to it about, you know, the future opportunity.
Yeah, I agree. I want to loop it back very quickly to cognitive biases that you kind of brushed upon in the beginning. I've done a lot of work in this area too, because I think it's so important. I think it's this invisible wall that sometimes holds us back from innovating, but we don't realize it because it's how our brains are wired and how we prefer things. And, you know, we've got this kind of tug of war between our ability to innovate. We all have that ability. And these cognitive bias, like, you know, our primal brain and the reticular activating system that acts like a brick wall to let in new stuff, and our longevity preference. I'm just curious from your perspective, how you see that kind of getting over the cognitive biases, because this may sound really naive, but it has been my experience that, you know, the first step of awareness of going, hey, whoa, I'm responding to this in a resisting kind of way because, you know, my lizard brain's like, whoa, now Tamara, let's not step out of our comfort zone. Let's stay comfortable in our little village over here. But even knowing that has helped me kind of push past that. I'm just curious if you've seen in your work something specific that helps people get over that, you know, those brick walls that are wired into us.
Well, I think implicit in what you just said, Tamara, is, you know, a little bit another way by of analogy, you know, kind of in the whole Alcoholics Anonymous program, right? You know, the first step is to admit you're an alcoholic, right?
Yeah,
so,
right. Yeah.
So I think there's an acknowledge piece of, you know, building a language, you know, and Daniel Kahneman and others have talked more eloquently about it than I have around behavioral economics. But first, building the language, and, you know, we talk about a number of these. You know, one is I talked about bounded rationality, which is, you know, the instinct to solve the problems based on the readily available information of today. You know, we're kind of lazy, right, on that, or automaticity, you know, we're sort of driven off of ingrained habits of how we do things or availability bias. So anyway, you know, and there's, I probably list about 8 of them or 9 of them here. You know, if there's one we could gain appreciation for the way our brains are wired, I think that's part of the solution, is just to have a understanding and awareness, as you said. I think the second thing is to recognize that some of us are more capable to overcome those biases than others. Some are just much more, going to be sort of delivery and programmatic and execute and operate oriented, and are going to just be in this space of these things that sort of reinforce that talent and that behavior. And others, just by whatever reason, are more discovery oriented, more capable of, you know, they're just entrepreneurial and they're creative, and they're not hung up on, you know, sort of the information they have. So I think the solution is, one, to sort of build a language about these biases, to know what you're up against individually and organizationally. And then second, organizationally, being able to parse between the talent of operate and execute, which is incredibly important for sustaining the core business and all the present forward work that needs to continue, but also being very thoughtful about selecting people who thrive in the discovery side of things and the exploration side, and having them not just on your innovation teams, but being a part of your management teams. That's how I think we overcome these biases.
Yeah, I like that. I thank you for talking about that. It's one of those things, particularly I think when we talk about innovation, and whether we're talking about it from an organizational level or it's all a bunch of individuals that make up an organization anyway, but I think it's remiss to not talk about the kind of a little bit of the wiring and why we do what we do. And I saw this study that is longevity preference. You've probably seen it. And I might get the numbers kind of wrong, but it was like the same chocolate bar, two groups. One group was told it was 3 years old. Another one was told it was basically 73 years old, like since they started selling it. And they almost always ranked the one that was 73 year old better tasting, even though it was the exact same bar.
Oh, interesting.
So they've done kind of a few studies like that. Same with a piece of art where they showed it to two different groups. Same kind of thing, like this is just painted, this is 200 years old. The one that's 200 years old always gets ranked as more appealing. So I think it's interesting that we have on one hand, we have these biases. On the other hand, we have this wiring in our brains for innovation. So what I love about your work, though, is I think it gives us a different kind of framework to get to that place faster. Kind of going future back to your point, I think forward facing is so laden with I envision all these kind of like ball and chains on you when you're doing it that way.
Well, and that was the other thing that we use this as, if nothing more, as a technique to, it's just a mechanism because of all of this, all of these biases and all of these difficulty. When you look out 5 to 10 years, as I mentioned, I think it's kind of playing a trick, it seems less risky, right? It allows people to be more comfortable in their conversation, as opposed to, if we were trying to have this, closer in and trying to think about this more creative mode, then it would be up against these biases in an even stronger way.
Yeah, I agree. And I think from what I'm hearing from you, I think as I take my takeaway from this is one of the keys, I think, in kind of going future back is really giving myself permission to not overanalyze every thought that I have and just be a little bit more expansive, at least in the start, of what the possibilities are. I think it's very easy to like put today's judgment on tomorrow's thinking too soon.
Yes, no, for sure. I think like you said, it gives you the permission. It takes the emotion, I think, what we've experienced out of it, because people are saying, oh, well, that's, that's 8 years from now. I might not even be here.
Right.
Some will say. So they don't feel so threatened. Right. And so we find that it just creates a safe space too, to be able to say, look, we're not going to try to do everything at once. We're talking about this is 8 years. We'll then talk about how would we get from here to there. And we got to do that in a staged, risk mitigated way. But that vision that could be transformative is less threatening, because by being 8 years, 5 to 10 years out or whatever, everybody recognizes that, we can develop a more longer path. We can slow things down, as opposed to if we talked about something transformative and, you know, we talked about it 2 years out, people go, holy cow, we're going to break the business, right? It, you know, this is a revolution. You know, we want to try to make it an evolution, not a revolution.
I love that. All right. I can't believe we've gone so far over time because this was so good. So to wrap up, where can people go to learn more, get the book, connect with you?
Well, I think, you know, three ways. One is I'm a very open person, transparent. And in fact, transparency is one of our firm values. So anybody want to connect with me directly, they can do so at mjohnson@innosight.com. Or they could go to our website, www.innosight.com, for either the book or, you know, further talk discussion. And then, of course, the book itself would be available on Amazon. And it's, again, Lead from the Future.
Awesome. So what's your final piece of advice for innovators? Actually, I'm going to say this more specifically. What is your piece of advice for all of us innovators on Launch Street to turn our visionary thinking into breakthrough growth, actually take action on it?
Well, I think my final piece of advice would be, do not be afraid of the 5 to 10 year horizon and put yourself in it and live in it for at least some portion of time, and be surprised about how many ahas come out of spending time in that future, and recognize then that there is a way to walk it back and to get started with a set of experiments to bring that exciting future alive.
By the way, I love that you use the word experiments, and I've no doubt that that's intentional. I also saw a study talking about how like the word experiment versus the word activity task. So we see our brain sees activities and tasks as work, and like that, therefore the lizard brain's like, that's too much work for our brain. And experiments open up a sense of discovery and playfulness. So for leaders out there, you've heard it in Mark's language this whole time. Using the word experiments actually helps your team get over that hump of like, oh, all you're doing is adding more work to my plate. I don't want to have to do this. This is like going to be exhausting. The word experiments has a whole different response.
Yeah. And I think that perhaps is the final message, especially for leadership teams, is that an organization and an individual's ability to continue to grow and thrive means that we, especially in this world, we can never stop learning. And the other way to look at this is all just about making sure that we are really strong in our ability to learn. And this hopefully is a way to ensure that happens within leadership and innovation teams.
Well, that is a great note to end on, Mark. Thank you so much for coming by. As you can tell by the time I kept you over, this was a very insightful interview.
Oh, thank you, Tamara. I'm excited. You asked great questions and it was a lot of fun. So we obviously are kindred spirits, right?
Yeah, just a little bit.
Thanks for hanging with us on Inside Launch Street. If you know someone that is truly ready to unlock their innovation advantage, have them join you on Launch Street. Discover your innovation advantage. Build a team of high-performing innovators and ignite ideas and solutions that create massive impact. GOTO, LaunchStreet.com. Remember, innovators, if you don't take the leap, somebody else will.